from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this program is being recorded late in the week. So here's what we knew late in the week that I'm sure is all, it's all changed by the weekend. I'm sure everything's better. But here's what we knew by late middle of the week. From a conservative newspaper in London, The Telegraph. The American-led reconstruction effort in Iraq is in chaos, quotes, and suffering from, quote, a complete absence of strategic direction, a very senior British official in Baghdad has told The Telegraph. The comments paint a grim picture of American incompetence. Oh, hey, listen, we're evil, but we're not incompetent. Maybe we're incompetent, but we're not evil. And mismanagement as the Coalition Provisional Authority struggles to run post-Saddam Iraq, said the official at midweek. This is the single most chaotic organization I have ever worked for. Unquote. Obviously, never a cast member at Saturday Night Live. The source revealed that Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator in Iraq, had, quote, fewer than 800 staff under his control to run a country the size of France. I thought it was the size of California. Can we get an agreement on what size Iraq is before? That is chaotic. In which the civil infrastructure was on the point of collapse. The operation is chronically under-resourced and suffers from an almost complete absence of strategic direction, said the source to The Telegraph. The Times, another conservative English newspaper, says British troops could be stuck in Iraq for up to 4 years if pro-Saddam Hussein militias continue to undermine coalition efforts to bring security to the country. 4 years. It's after the next election, isn't it? But here's what's really changed between midweek and the weekend. I'm sure, ladies and gentlemen, this can't stand. Robin Cook and Claire Short, two former members of Tony Blair's cabinet who resigned over the war, were told by MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service of Britain, in the period before the invasion of Iraq, that Saddam Hussein did not have any weapons of mass destruction capable of posing a threat to British security. In separate appearances before Parliament, the two former cabinet members revealed for the first time the source for their damaging claims that Tony Blair misled Britain over the war. They had each received regular personal briefings from officers of MI6, the secret intelligence service, who had persuaded them that Saddam Hussein was not a current and serious threat. In the United States, Senator John Kerry finally mustered up the spizzarinctum this week to claim that President Bush lied to us all, quote-unquote, but didn't provide the source for his information. Maybe he reads the British papers. But enough about that. Congratulations, news from across the sea as well. Congratulations to Europe, which in the past week or so adopted its first Europe-wide constitution. Now you guys have something to violate. Hello, welcome to the show.
The great nation of Europe, they gathered on the shore. They conquered what was behind them. Now they wanted more. So they went to the mighty ocean and took to the western sea. The great nation of Europe in the 16th century. Hide your wives and daughters, hide the groceries too. Great nation of Europe coming through. Grand Canary Islands, the first land to which they came. They slaughtered all the canaries there, which gave the land its name. There were natives there called Guanches, Guanches by the score. But it's disease the Portuguese, they weren't there anymore. Now they're gone. You won't find a live one, no matter where you look. Hide your wives and daughters, hide the groceries too. Great nation of Europe coming through. Columbus sailed for India, found Salvador instead. He shook hands with some Indian, soon
TB and typhoid and athlete's foot, diphtheria and the flu. Excuse me, Drake, passion's cutting through. Balboa found the Pacific, and on a trail one day, he met some friendly Indians, whom he was told were gay. So he had them torn apart by dogs on religious grounds, they say. Great nations of Europe were quite holy in their way. Now they're gone, they're really gone. Standing the end of a century, Europe's have sprung up everywhere, as even I can see. There on the horizon is a possibility. Some bug from out of Africa might come for you and me, destroying everything in its path from sea to shining sea, like the great nations of Europe in the 16th century.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this very special edition of the show, the program that asks the question, why is Mahmoud Abbas, the new prime minister of Palestine, also known as Abu Mazen? Now, ladies and gentlemen, I've Googled this subject. I've gone to several biographies of Mahmoud Abbas, where it's always stated as if, well, you know, also known as Abu Mazen, without any explanation of why this guy, this prime minister, alone among all the prime ministers of the great nations of the world, is also known as anything, has an AKA as part of his bio. President George W. Bush, also known as Jimmy Zippo, today. What? You'd stop. You'd think. So that's the question. Answers invited. And now, the apologies of the week.
So sorry.
Not too many this week. Dateline Macomb. Believe this is, it's Michigan, looks like. Macomb County man who spent nearly a decade in prison for rape is free this week after DNA evidence showed he didn't commit the crime. All charges against Kenneth Wynyemko were dropped and he was released this week. The now 52-year-old had been sentenced to 40 to 60 years in prison for the 1994 rape and armed robbery of a 28-year-old Clinton Township woman. No DNA testing was done at the time of his conviction. Macomb County Prosecutor Carl Marlinga says he sincerely apologized to Wynyemko and hopes to get his life back on track. Thanks for caring. Dateline Amman, King Abdullah II of Jordan pardoned a Japanese journalist this week. He'd been sentenced to 18 months in jail for accidentally killing a Jordanian airport guard with a cluster bomb in his luggage. How does that happen? Simple. Another journalist who brought back a souvenir from Iraq. Hiroki Gomi had taken the bomb from Iraq as a souvenir. He was passing through security at the Amman airport when an X-ray machine detected the bomb. It exploded as the guard searched the bag, killing him and wounding three other people. Gomi, a photographer for Japan's Mainichi Shimbun newspaper, said he didn't know the bomb was live. He was talking on his cell phone several feet away when it exploded. He was convicted of negligence in the guard's death, but acquitted of illegal possession of an explosive device. The king decreed special clemency for Gomi, said the newspaper in a statement. We're deeply appreciative of the generous decision taken by the king. We would like to again express our sorrow over the victim's death and apologize to the injured and all those affected by this incident. That's true. Why apologize to the dead man? He won't hear it. And refusing to apologize this week, former Oklahoma Governor Frank Keating resigned as chairman of the church-appointed panel that is seeking to resolve the sexual abuse scandal involving priests and minors. He refused to apologize for comparing the church's behavior in the matter to the mafia. Now, ladies and gentlemen, from the Independent in London, he is big, brown, and a very, very soft bear who likes nothing better than adventure in the woods and helping to boost the sales of toilet paper. Procter & Gamble was accused this week of marketing its leading toilet tissue to toddlers by bringing out a children's book based on the cartoon character used to advertise the brand on TV. A million copies of The Adventures of Charmin the Bear, a 32-page paperback book aimed at two to four-year-olds, have been printed and will go on sale in bookstores in England next month for about $6. Executives at Procter & Gamble insist the book is designed to encourage parents to read with their young children. The book also carries the logo of the National Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, which received a grant from Procter & Gamble. Charmin the Bear. Language in the book closely mimics the qualities Procter & Gamble attributes to Charmin and its toilet paper. The phrase, soft and comfortable, appears 9 times in the first story, and the main character is described in the second as being softer than a feather. The third story repeats the words big and strong 5 times. And in the fourth, Charmin is called a very, very soft bear. In the fifth story, yet to be written, I guess, he will also be noted as being unusually absorbent. For a bear. We're in the New Orleans Le Show Dome with Joe Crown, another of the people who knocked me out in New Orleans with his keyboard wizardry. And Joe, you're a double threat at the very least, because you play piano, but you're also master of the Hammond B3. But we have a piano here today. We don't have an organ, so.
That's right. We're doing it on piano today.
Start at the beginning. You're not from New Orleans. Where are you from?
I grew up in New York, specifically Westbury, New York. That's on Long Island. And when I got to the age of about 20, I moved up to Boston.
I'm sorry about that.
Well, it was an experience, a cold experience.
I had that experience about the same age.
And around 1991, I got a call to fill in some work with Clarence Gatemouth Brown. I was at the time working with Luther Guitar Jr. Johnson, who was the last guitar player in the last great Muddy Waters band. after Muddy died, Luther had his own career going. He still does. He's doing pretty well. But I was out there with Luther at the time, playing keyboards, touring around the world with Luther, and the call came in to play with Gate, and I went and filled in a couple of gigs, and then I stayed in touch with Gate, and when the job opened up, I joined the band permanently in 1992. I just moved down here, and I haven't looked back since. I've been playing music down here. I had been on the road a lot with Gate. Gate was a pretty much a 6 month a year, not 6 months solid, but over a course of a year, we'd be gone about 150, 175 days of the year. So it was a little hard at first to get established in the community, but after, you know, you stay around for a while, you can get your footing in with several people, so that after a while, every time I came off the road, I would be working a lot. And so starting around 1997, I started making my own records. And the first one was a solo piano performance called Just the Piano, Just the Blues. And I record for a local New Orleans label, STR Digital Records. And since then, I am now on number 5. It's the follow-up to my first record. And in between the first record and the fifth record, I did 3 records playing organ, fronting Hammond B3 organ, fronting a band. And that's when I play organ, I like to front a band. When I play piano, I like to do it solo.
Tell me about a little bit about the organ band. Obviously, Jimmy Smith influence, yeah?
Well, yeah, I mean, when I play anything that I play, I've always had the mind of going back and studying the roots of it. When I play piano, I like to study all the, you know, the boogie-woogie guys, the ragtime. I love listening to the jazz players, you know, Oscar Peterson, Bill Evans. And, you know, I feel that it's important to really, whatever you're going to do, is to try to get to some sort of a root of it. And when I started playing organ, I've been playing organ, I grew up playing piano, and I started playing organ about 20 years ago, 25 years ago. I went right for Jimmy Smith. You know, he's the guy. And after, he was the guy that kind of everybody kind of followed suit afterwards. And I don't know, when you talk about luck and timing, it all had to do with the development of the organ at the time. And there were great organ players before him, but he was really the first guy. Like basically 1955, they developed the B3. Before that, there were B2s, CVs, BVs, but the B3 is the instrument that we all know now, and the only difference was it had this percussion effect on it, which became Jimmy Smith's trademark, which everybody thereafter copied. Mm. So I went and studied Jimmy Smith and, you know, Jack McDuff and Jimmy McGriff and all those guys, and then, you know, I started listening to people like Booker T and Art Neville,
yeah.
And the whole thing about the organ is that, well, first of all, I don't sing, so I play instrumental music, and I'm not a jazz player. So when I get out in front of a band, I want to do it in the organ combo format. The organ combo is the organ is the voice of the band. There's not a singer. The organ plays the melodies. It is the sound that you hear first. It is the voice of the band. Booker T was an organ combo. The earlier guys, Jimmy Smith, that's an organ combo. The meters were a form of an organ combo. It's not about singing and hearing lyrics. It's about the instrument of the organ being the voice of the band.
Hearing you talk about the history of the instrument, I'm reminded of the fact that when I was a kid and my parents would take me to a restaurant for dinner, which was a big deal, there would very often be a guy sitting at an organ playing solo. It was right before, you know, the organ crossed over into being a rhythmic, jazzy, hip instrument, and it was still living in this corner of a restaurant, being kind of, well, I'll do these orchestral effects for your for your dining pleasure, you know, ladies and gentlemen. And that marred me for a long time. The word organ music meant either that or ice skating rink, you know.
Well, you know, the epitome of that is Radio City Music Hall. They have two organ players. That's the band. One on each side of the stage. Originally, in the 40s, as the big band started to die down, they realized that they could use this Hammond organ to replace the big bands. And
basically, it was the synthesizer history before the
synthesizer. Yeah. It was the effect. It was a pre-synthesizer effect of just downscaling the band and still getting the punch of a horn section. You can use this organ. And they played these big block chords, and they played all the horn lines. And then all of a sudden, you know, just like the guitar, they all of a sudden realized, gee, you know, this could be something we can put out in front, you know. And because at a certain point in time, the guitar was just something that just sat in the back playing quarter notes, jing, 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 in the Count Basie band. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden they got the electric guitar, and T-Bone Walker and Gatemouth Brown got in front of a band and floored everybody. And the next thing you know, before that, it was all the saxophone. And the next thing you know, the guitar became the phenomena. Well, it didn't happen quite like that with the organ, but it did move out in front eventually.
But enough about organ for the moment. You're here to play piano. This is a great piano town, is it not?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, this is where so many great piano players were given birth to, and I don't mean in the physical sense, but in the musical sense. And people like Dr. John and Professor Longhair and Alan Toussaint and James Booker, Fats Domino. I mean, this was a piano mecca for me. So when I got offered the job to come down and play with Gate, I was like, I don't have to think about that too hard. And once I got down here, I really realized why this city has given birth to so many great musicians, period. First of all, there's so many of them, and the competition is very, very high. And second of all, there's so much work down here. I mean, every corner of the city, there's pockets of all kinds of things to do. And no matter what you do, you can find a place to play it. And it just really is a very creative environment.
Play a little something to show us what you've been working on.
I'm kind of warmed up on this one, so let me do it.
Thank you.
which the answer is yes, I do know. Joe Crown. I have to ask you this because it's such the obvious question. K-R-O-W-N, your real name?
Yes, it is.
Wow.
Actually, I'm named after my great-grandfather, and he was the first. It's funny, this is not the first time I've been asked this question.
Well.
But I guess he was the first one. He came over on the boat, and he had some Eastern European last name that I have no knowledge of, but he was the first one that was a Crown. And my grandfather, my father, myself, my brother, my sister, all of us, we are Crowns.
Oh, well, congratulations, because there's a lot of kings that aren't real kings. So
yes, there are. we know about that.
But you're a real Crown. You say you're not a jazz player, but New Orleans-style piano has got an awful lot of jazzy, I guess, flavors and influences. Is there a way that you hear a guy and you say, well, that guy's playing New Orleans style, or he's been influenced by New Orleans or not, you know,
well,
when you hear it?
The New Orleans piano thing really gets distinctive around Professor Longhair. He kind of like changed a lot of the way that the New Orleans piano style was going. You know, they say the guy before Professor Longhair was Toots Washington, and when you listen to Toots play, he was just basically an R&B boogie-woogie piano player. Nothing that different than the Kansas City guys or, you know, the St. Louis guys or any of that kind of stuff. It was just another one of the house rock and piano players. When Professor Longhair came in, he kind of put this new twist that we down here tend to call the mambo. A little bit of a different flavor to it, and they say it's a mix of Caribbean music. Back in the 40s, that they used to pick up radio signals that came from the islands, and not that Professor Longhair was the genius that all of a sudden came up, invented this new sound. They say there were people before him that played it. This whole thing of who invents what and everything like that, 90% of the time, the guy you think that invents it is probably not the guy. He's just the guy that got popular for it. He probably heard it somewhere, but he's just the guy that got the first hit with it or recorded with it or something. We like to think that, you know, Professor Longhair was really the guy that changed it. And I'll give you an example of, of something. This is a song which is actually the lead off cut on my new CD, New Orleans Piano Rolls, which is a solo piano performance. And this is a very popular New Orleans tune called Tipitina. Thank you. that's pretty definitive New Orleans. And from that kind of stuff, guys like Huey Piano Smith, and they all kind of came up with some, you know, that Rockin' Pneumonia, Boogie Woogie Flu, the whole open... I mean, that's all. That all comes from that whole Professor Longhair thing. One of the front guys of all the New Orleans pianos is, of course, Dr. John, who's been one of my big-time idols. I got one of those, like, you know, homespun workbooks, and we got them on cassette back then.
Yeah.
And the first thing, you know, I put the cassette in. I'm like, let's see what he's got to say. And the first thing out of his mouth is like, well, just listen to Fess. You know, and that was it, you know. And then I was like, what's this Fess thing? And boy, there it was. And that's where he got it all from. And, you know,
Fess meaning Professor Longhair.
Professor Longhair. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
It's funny. I've finally gotten to meet him and know him, and he's quite a good guy.
You're describing a few minutes ago the profusion of places to play and people who play here. Would you describe this scene? I think people who follow jazz and have heard stories about the New York scene have heard how almost insanely competitive it is. Would you say this scene is competitive in that way? Or
there is a lot of competition. You know, everybody looks down at everybody, you know. I mean, you always get, like, the purists looking down at those that aren't the purists, and that happens in the jazz world, in the blues world, in the funk world. You know, you're not playing pure funk, you know, you're not this. But I'll tell you, this is a small city, and there's just so much live work going on and call for live work that a lot of it gets put aside just to keep the work going. And, you know, there's such an abundance of talent in this town, and the problems that people have down here in playing music is usually not the playing music. It has to do with personal problems and egos and professionalism. And so even when the purest of the purists need a player, they go down the book and they say, God, that guy plays, but I just can't deal with him. God, that guy plays, but he always shows up late. he always cancels, you know? So it's like a lot of stuff gets put aside just to make the work. And that's why you tend to get people playing with different people that are, you know, that inspire you. You know, a lot of places you wouldn't get chances to play with great players like someone like George Porter or Johnny Vodakovich or Herman Ernest or David Torkanowski. But when they need a player, they need a player. When they need somebody that's going to show up and do the gig, they might take less of a player and put him on the gig because they need somebody who's just going to be there and do the job. And those younger players get to play with these great seasoned players, and they get a few lessons in the process.
That's one of the things that amazes me about this place is if you're here long enough, you hear almost everybody playing with almost everybody.
That's one of the reasons why. And, I mean, being a band leader, I have every musician's phone number in the town, because there's always that last minute gig that comes in. Can, you know, it's Thursday. We had a cancellation for Saturday. Can you put a band together? Get the Rolodex out and start going down the list. I got the top of the list. I got the bottom of the list. Then I got underneath the bottom of the list. And, you know, I get whoever I need to get. And sometimes I shake the tree and somebody comes out that just is like, why haven't we worked together before? You know? And the next thing you know, we're playing together all the time.
Your new record is called New Orleans Piano Rolls. There's almost a sense here that because the storehouse of songs connected with or associated with the city is so big that you kind of have to touch those bases as a way of saying, I'm building on that. I'm standing.
Exactly. And you know, as a member of the music community, you really have to acknowledge that in some sort of a way.
Would you do something else?
Of course.
Of your choosing?
Thank you.
Do you have to be able to play tenths in your left hand to work in this town?
Well, I like to play it, but, you know, James Booker could never play it.
Is that true?
I never met the man, yeah. But he had supposedly very small hands, and he had this very unique style of playing, which they called the butterfly stride. And he would do something where he would hit a low note and then a chord. And I used to listen to it, and I'm like, what is that about? You know, I mean, it's playing upside down. You think you do the downbeat on the low note, you know, like that. Mm-hmm. But his low note was the pickup. The downbeat was on the chord, and it was a very, very weird kind of way of playing that was very unique. And he's got such an identifiable style, mostly because of that, but he had very small hands and had that whole problem playing the tenths with that. And he developed this little thing that became his whole trademark because of it.
Wow.
Obviously, he had a very tragic life. Yeah. He died at a very young age, late 30s, early 40s or something, and he was a very big substance abuser, and he died waiting for help in the emergency room of Charity Hospital.
Mm.
And I mean, tragic. He had classic, you know, genius gone over the edge kind of thing. And he was supposedly one of these prodigies that just played everything, anything from classical up and down, backwards and forwards, and just outplayed everybody. And again, and here's another example. He had problems working because he wouldn't show. He'd show up all stoned. He would be, you never knew what you were going to get out of him.
Well, you hear some of these live, very, very bad sounding, but amazing live recordings of him where he's going from Rachmaninoff to Boogie Woogie in the flash of and back again. And it's just,
I mean, it's amazing. And, you know, I mean, I played at the Maple Leaf on Monday nights for 5 years, solo piano.
So you played on that piano?
No, it was a different one.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I think he threw up on that one a little too many times. But I did it because it was like a traditional thing. You know, I really wanted to make my mark, and the Maple Leaf was where James did it. And I really wanted to follow that whole, like, you know, history and the ghosts of the piano players before kind of thing. I did it for 5 years, and the piano was pretty busted up, and I really enjoyed it, but I would, you know, the guys that were there on Mondays, like John Parsons and Hank Staples, were there when James was there. I mean, John owned the bar. John actually had the tapes of all the Booker recordings, and he was involved with releasing some of that stuff, and they would tell me stories about Booker just coming in and just, they never knew what he was going to do. But he was Booker, and you just always had to have him there. And that's, you know, that was the greatness in it. So
yeah, that's one of my regrets, is I came here too late to
me
see
too.
That. Yeah.
I never heard him play live or Professor Longhair, you know. So, but I sat up north freezing, listening to the records, hearing about it, you know.
Joe, because players can play and work here almost every night, I guess, if you're I guess you face the choice of, I can stay in town where I'm comfortable and where I can work all the time, or I can go out on that kind of awful road. And
well, it's funny that you mentioned that. I was talking to a newspaper writer yesterday, and they were asking me about what's my feelings about going on the road. I think everybody should do it. Every musician should go out and be on the road, live the Spinal Tap life. Understand that is reality, and that it's laughing at the reality that there's a lot to see out in the world. Playing music is one way to see it, and there really is a lot of crazy things that go on out there. And I mean, there is that. The thing about being in New Orleans, yes, you can stay and make a living if you get your act together, learn a few different styles of music. I call it learning the books, you know, whether it be Cajun music or trad jazz or just cocktail piano, you know, just learn as many different styles as you can and the tunes that are associated with that. Be professional. You can work a whole lot in this city. Mm. And you never have to go on the road. You can raise a family, as I am. And or you can go on the road because people come from all over the world to tap into this New Orleans music that we do down here. So you get a lot more opportunities being a New Orleans musician than a Peoria, Illinois musician. After playing with Clarence Gatemouth Brown for 12 years, touring the world 20 times, 30 times over, I'm sick of flying. I'm sick of sitting on tour buses. I'm sick of being away from my family. If I never go on the road again, I'll be happy. If I go out on the road again, I'm fine with that. You know, I can go either way, basically.
It's a lot easier to laugh about the road when you're traveling with other musicians, though. The solo road thing.
Well, it is easier in certain ways, but it's infectious because when you're in misery out there and you're with five guys that are in misery, it tends to breed even more misery. You know, one guy is just cutting on everything that's going on, and it just people get sucked into it, and it really does happen. Mm. And you know, if you can keep it positive out there, you know, when things start going haywire, and you know, Harry, that they always will go haywire.
As they do, yeah.
If you can keep positive about it and keep everybody in a positive frame of mind, then it never gets negative. You know, I mean, we in 1995, Gatemouth opened for Eric Clapton for 62 dates, and of course, on that level, there is never anything wrong with it. And if there is, the band never finds out about it because the crew is like the top of the industry. And the concerts are sold out, 15,000 seat arenas every night. And there's no Air Force bases and stupid conventions and VFW halls and inexperienced people out there. It's big money with everything trickling
first
down
class.
There.
Yeah.
And the energy for that band was just always positive. And of course, you'd like to keep that energy so that when you do get onto the smaller levels and you pull up after driving for 3 days to a VFW and they haven't promoted it and whatever, it's hard to keep that positive energy, but you got to really try to.
I was out solo opening for a pretty prominent act, and they hadn't promoted the fact that I was on the bill, and it was Pittsburgh the night after Christmas. And I thought this was a pretty cool act because, you know, their fans wouldn't be too out of line. It's the night after Christmas. The drugs, they'd taken the drugs to kick in for the band. And right. I was not there for when the drugs happened. Or I was there when the drugs happened instead of the band. And literally, I was in the cashier's office of the venue, and the guy was, if it hadn't been for the road manager of the band I was opening for saying, no, you are going to pay him.
Right.
I would have gotten stiffed on the night, you know. And
oh, yeah.
So that is hard to keep positive energy when that's happening.
Oh, and I mean, you think it's bad now. I hear the stories from Gate. When in the early 50s, when he had to go out to the car and get the pistol and tell BB to wait out there with the motor running and stuff, you know?
Wow.
I mean, it was, you know, the stories of trying to deal with club owners back then, and everybody was just constantly trying to screw those guys and take money out of their pockets. And, you know, it's easier, you know, after hearing the stories, it's easy for me to understand why some of the older, especially some of the black musicians tend to be the way they are about people trying to take advantage of them with recording and all kinds of stuff. Because, you know, times were very different back then for whites and blacks.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, I mean, they were totally taken advantage of.
Well, you know, there's this thing called the Rhythm and Blues Foundation, and they have a benefit. Yeah,
now.
Yeah, and they have a benefit every year to pay the medical expenses of these guys who got... And you just, if you think about why they have to have that benefit,
exactly,
it's because these guys got so systematically ripped off,
right?
That when you read nowadays about the record industry, for example, chasing after kids on the internet and talking about artists' rights, you think, well, these guys, these old guys, must be laughing bitter laughs, you know, when they hear the words artists' rights coming out of the mouths of record company people.
What was it like somewhere in the 80s when the Rolling Stones helped out Willie Dixon?
Yeah.
Didn't that happen?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
All of a sudden he was like, you know, just barely cutting it. And now he's got millions of dollars because of all the songs he's written that everybody's covered. But you and I have talked about at every level of every part of the art industry, from acting to music to just pure artists, you know, there's always going to be somebody who is going to stand on your shoulders, who's going to walk in front of you, who just when you think you've reached a certain level, there's always going to be someone who's going to do better, and that you're going to say, I wish I was there. And why can't I have that opportunity? And the only thing you can really do is just really stay focused on what you're out, what you set out to do to begin with. I set out to make some music. I set out to make some good music. I set out to play music every day. I set out to, whatever it is that you set out to do, just focus on that, because there's always going to be somebody that's the Johnny come lately who's going to beat you out and get that award or get that part in a movie or, you know, whatever it is, who's going to just like, every time you turn around, you see their name instead of yours. And there's nothing you can do about that.
You can stop reading the paper.
Yeah, you can. you can live in a shack out in the middle of the woods with no TV and no newspaper, but that's not the answer.
That's not the answer. Playing more music is the answer.
Well, I've been talking about Boogie Woogie, so let me hit on one of those.
Yeah.
Boogie Woogie.
Is that the most fun to play?
I love Boogie Woogies. When I heard that as a kid, that was it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Really?
Yeah, that was what I wanted to play. And I mean, I love playing them. It's taken me a while to get comfortable. The left hand stuff is
a bitch.
Can wear you out. Someone once asked me, how do you keep that left hand going? It's like, practice it for 20 years. You know, it's just.
Did you start by trying to play at that speed, or do you start by playing speed?
No. I couldn't even do. You know, I mean, I couldn't even do that for more than a few minutes. You know, when I was a kid, and I remember seeing people when I was a kid do that, and I was just like, oh, God, how do they do that? And I remember there was a time where I couldn't even play any sort of an octave, like, you know, do. You know, in my right hand, play any kind of melody with an octave, and just seeing people go, I was like, oh my God, you know. And then after a while, you know, after hours and hours and hours, and did I say hours enough?
You
of
did
practice,
say hours, yeah.
It really, you know, it, a lot of it, like you said, is persistence. You know, just staying with it and just, you know, doing it over and over. And even as much as you do it over and over, there's songs I play every night, like years, I still make mistakes in them. I still, you know, forget how things go in them. And it's just, you just got to stay with it, you know, keep it fresh. And it's just, you know, it's just, it's an ongoing work at all times.
You mentioned you have a couple of originals on this CD.
Yeah.
Would you like to finish up by playing one of them?
Sure. This is a tune I call The More Women Shuffle. And I spelled Moore, M-O-O-R-E. There's a little story behind that because my wife's maiden name is Moore. And my wife and her sisters and all the female women in that family tend to not lift their feet when they walk. Yeah, it's like they're always wearing slippers or something, you know. And even my daughter, and we're walking through the parking lot, lift your feet, please. You know? So I wrote a tune to kind of say a little salute to those females in my wife's family, my in-laws, my daughter, my wife, my mother-in-law does it too. So this is kind of how it goes.
Ladies and gentlemen, one more note on the week's news. We know that the mistreatment of Jessica Lynch, even though she's been rescued from Iraq, her mistreatment has just begun. It was reported this week that she signed for agency representation with ICM. Ouch. My thanks to Joe Crown for being with us today, and my thanks to Drew at Piety Street Recording in New Orleans for recording the interview and the performance. The show returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR Worldwide, throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the East Coast on the shortwave giant WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio, and around the world via the Internet whenever you want it at harryshearer.com and kcrw.com. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.